This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony. Mozart wrote his last three symphonies in the space of just a few months in 1788. Number 41, The Jupiter, is said to have been Mozart's bid for symphonic greatness, and number 39 was written for the sheer joy of writing music. But it is number 40 that would seem to give us the best insight into what was going on in Mozart's head and heart during this crucial period of his life. It's restless, unsettled, constantly shifting, and always with an undercurrent of uncertainty. Where is it going next? 1788 was not a good year for Mozart. His music was falling out of fashion, and he was falling deeper into debt. Mozart was in desperate circumstances, and there is no hard evidence that he ever heard any of these last three symphonies performed in concert. We do know that, at the very least, the Symphony No. 40 was performed during Mozart's lifetime, though whether he was there for the concert, nobody knows. It was in April of 1791, 8 months before Mozart's death, and it was conducted by, of all people, Antonio Salieri, who is best known these days as Mozart's supposed nemesis. In reality, though, at least in this case, he was Mozart's benefactor, having organized the concerts, along with one of Mozart's best friends, the clarinetist Anton Stadler. The version of this symphony that was performed on that concert was not the one Mozart had originally written, though. Mozart hardly ever wrote anything without a specific occasion in mind, so the fact that the symphony as it was performed that evening included clarinet parts makes a strong case that it was Stadler who had helped make the concert possible by commissioning the new arrangement. It is also worth remembering that when Mozart died, deeply in debt, the only person who owed him money was Anton Stadler. Robert Schumann once wrote of the 40th Symphony's weightless Hellenic grace, but what the score suggests above all to us is urgency. Mozart establishes this immediately in the breathless, restless figure in the violas, which, for a second or two, precedes the actual melody. This must have astonished the audience at the premiere, an accompaniment only, and piano so soft, and then, reinforced by the melody itself, upbeat, leading to upbeat, leading to upbeat. The subtle way that Mozart distributes the melodic lines among the instruments is amazingly transparent, even for him. Never duplicating notes in the melody with notes in the accompaniment, the new atmosphere that is generated when the cellos and basses first play sustained rather than detached notes, and the stretching of horizons when he first brings in the woodwinds. Discrete supporting chords of oboes and bassoons make the repetition of the opening melody not just a repetition, but a continuation and a development. And all of this happens in just the first half minute. Mozart is setting us up. The harmony in these opening pages is simple, preparing us all the more effectively for the violent dislocations to come. The contrasting theme is scored in subtle dialogue between strings and woodwinds for maximum effect. It is momentarily disturbed by fever. Then the exposition charges energetically to its conclusion. A single rough chord sends the music back to the beginning, and after a repeat of the exposition, we arrive at the same place again. there's a moment of ambiguity when the movement seems to start all over again. But in just seconds, it is clear that things are getting more urgent. Mozart whirls the opening theme across great harmonic spaces, focusing more and more closely on its first three notes. The harmonies become more and more anguished until the flute joins in dialogue with the clarinets for a long descent, sending us into the recapitulation. But this time, the second theme is in the dark home key of G minor. And the coda rises to still hotter temperatures and deeper pathos. The andante is both somber and sensual, another, if milder, instance of the condition described by Charles Rosen in his book The Classical Style. In all of Mozart's supreme expressions of suffering and terror, writes Rosen, there is something shockingly voluptuous. The grief and the sensuality strengthen each other and end by becoming indivisible, indistinguishable from one another. In his corruption of sentimental values, Mozart is a subversive artist. End quote. The violas begin with an idea in repeated notes. The second violins and then the first violins join them in imitation at successively higher pitches. But what we're hearing now is not so much a theme as a texture. Just as we accept this unexpected idea, the response to these opening measures turns out to be a sweet and graceful melody. The first phrase ends, and then the repeated note idea begins again in the cellos and basses. But this time, the first violins add a soaring countermelody, whose course is completely unpredictable. Even though the tempo in the second movement is drastically different from the first, Mozart is still exploring the first movement's world of aching harmony, albeit more quietly. Polyphony is a technique in which two melodic lines compete with and complement each other at the same time. It was one of Mozart's favorite compositional devices. He used it powerfully in the first movement, and he brings it back again in the ruggedly stern minuet. The pastoral middle section is contrasting in both mood and harmony. If the first movement raised questions, positing instabilities and opening abysses, it's the finale that seeks to close those wounds, to bring the symphonic voyager safely, if somewhat bruised, into port. The finale also brings the most explosive music Mozart ever wrote, 8 measures of rude octaves and frozen silences that launched the development. The context for this disruption, though, is music more consistently regular in rhythm than anything we've heard in the rest of the symphony. Both the opening and the finale would seem to have a similar consistency of rhythm and mood, but those explosions are set against the normality of most of the finale, And along with the sense of direct momentum the movement generates, they are what most clearly establishes the difference between this movement and the opening Allegro. But for all the anguish Mozart still feels and expresses, and even though it is in this movement that he brings his language closest to the breaking point, the finale must at last be a force that stabilizes, that brings the symphony to a satisfying, if still unsettled, conclusion. The original version of Mozart's Symphony No. 40 is rarely heard these days, possibly because it is the added clarinets that bring the symphony closer to that combination of suffering and voluptuousness that Charles Rosen described. In the 1880s, when the original version was the one most often heard, Johannes Brahms acquired a copy of the clarinet version, which he refused to release for publication. The more we know about both versions and both composers, it is clear why this version was the one closest to Brahms' heart, and now to ours. This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony.